We have come in our study to Daniel chapter 7, and you have quite a thick packet that I've handed you. Because though the main message to the Gentiles is actually Daniel chapters 4 and 5, because that's the peak of the chiastic structure, the information in chapters 2 and 7 are the foundations for the Gentile rebellion that's recorded in chapters 3 and 6. The issue in chapter 2 was that God revealed to the leading Gentile ruler how history was going to run. And the vision was significantly impressive that Nebuchadnezzar simply felt like he had to have an explanation, because he was having the dream, apparently, night after night, and he was losing sleep, and he didn't understand it, but there was enough information in the vision that even a person who couldn't understand visions and dreams could still feel like that there was something pretty ominous here somehow. Because the end of the vision, this huge, impressive man figure was pulverized into dust by this stone that was cut out of the mountain without hand. That was the essential issue that Nebuchadnezzar rebelled against. In general terms, he simply rebelled against the Word of God. But in terms of specific things, what he was really rebelling against was God's control. The thing that every human being, Gentile, Jew, or Martian, needs to understand, that God's God. And that's the bottom line in beginning to understand anything, truly, because the fear of the Lord is the beginning of understanding. And it was God's overt declaration to King Nebuchadnezzar that world history was going to pass him by, and there were going to be three other kingdoms after him, that instigated his desire to solidify the Babylonian Empire by using a religious unity. So he built this image 90 feet tall and all that. The whole point was to force everybody in the empire to come around to one object of worship, which, in spite of the fact that human beings give lip service to bowing down before idols of wood and stone and all that kind of stuff, they really, none of them believe that that idol has any... I mean, they know. They go out in the wood and they cut down a tree and they make half of it into firewood and the other half they turn it into a god, and they know good and well that they made the God, and that's the whole point. They want to be the one that's in control, and they want to even be in control of, quote, the gods. And that was what Nebuchadnezzar despised, and that's what everybody hates. You get into the issues of life, and everybody wants some way to manipulate and control their own experiences to make things work out their own way. That's their major problem with God. And even believers, I mean, you listen to the way we tell God what to do. We call it prayer, but we're really telling him what to do. And a lot of times, we do it in an asking way, but our asking is almost always focused on what we want to see happen. And there's nothing particularly wrong with expressing a wish. But there's just an awful lot of conflict even in the hearts of believers over things that happen that God either instigates or permits, and they get ticked. That's why Paul told the Thessalonians, don't stop praying. Because he knew that one of the first things people do when they get sufficiently injured by something that happened to them, as far as they're concerned, is that they get mad at God and quit talking to him. Paul said, don't do that. Talk your way through it with him. And even Psalms, David, when you read about all the things that God let David go through before Saul finally died, it's just so grossly unfair. I mean, it's just, he's hounded and hounded and hounded and hounded, and his own men are telling him, kill him, kill him. And, you know, the people that he protects turn on him, they go tell Saul where he is, all that kind of stuff. And you get to thinking that this is the pits. But that's really what the book of Job's all about in the Old Testament. Who's God and who's really worthy of owning our loyalty and being in control of the circumstances. But this is what's going on in the Gentile world, and that's why Daniel wrote chapters 2 through 7 in the language of the Chaldeans, because the first step in coming to grips with all of those things that we understand now as the promises of eternal life are rooted in one bottom line thing, and that's the decision about who's going to be in control here. So, when we look in chapter 2, and then we look in chapter 7, we actually have two chapters in the book that are the bookends of this chiastic structure that outline the future of human history from Babylon to the Messiah's kingdom. And yet, there are significant issues in trying to interpret Daniel. So as we've worked our way through, we've looked at some of the little hints along the way that help us to understand. For example, if you'll turn past the note part to the first handout thing, it says the history of imperialism. That's just my wording. But it's a timeline of history given prophetically and partially validated by historical developments. In the prophecy of chapter 2, you had this golden head that was identified by Daniel as, "You are the King of Kings, you are the head of gold." And he tied the gold issue with the royalty issue of being king. And he said of Nebuchadnezzar, "You are the King of Kings, you are the head of gold." And then he said, "After you will arise another kingdom which will be inferior to you." But the inferiority is the step down from gold to silver, which is inferiority in terms of value, but not in terms of strength. Because silver is stronger than gold is. And bronze is stronger than silver is. And iron is stronger than any of them. So you have this descending in terms of inferiority in terms of metal, but you have this ascending issue in terms of strength. So that when you get to the fourth beast, which is iron and whatnot, he's massively powerful. So in chapter 2, you had this gold head, which is identified as Babylon by Daniel. And the kingdom of Babylon ran to 538 B.C. That's when Belshazzar died and Darius the Mede took over. Then the silver is the Medo-Persian group. The Medes and the Persians were in an alliance, and Darius the Mede and Cyrus the Persian were contemporary in their authorities, and that's why at the end of the record in chapter 5, Daniel prospers in the reign of Darius the Mede and Cyrus the Persian. So we actually have the Persian, the Medes and the Persians identified by Daniel as the silver upper body, chest, and so forth. And that empire, according to the history, and when I first studied this, I just used an encyclopedia to look for the historical stuff. And I've told you this before, but I'll tell you again tonight. The book of Daniel, up through the period of the Maccabean era, was so accurate in terms of the details of the prophecies that the liberals never questioned the legitimacy or the accuracy. What they questioned was the authorship. They started out with the a priori assumption that there's no such thing as prophecy. So if you have a book written by a guy supposed to be Daniel, supposed to be in the 6th century B.C., writing stuff that happened back in all the way down to 175 and in that period's time, and even further than that, they said this had to have been written during the Maccabean period. It had to be, because there's no such thing as prophecy, and these all these words are too accurate. So that was their answer until the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls. But anyway, the bronze belly was the third kingdom that would arise. And that one's identified later in the book of Daniel as Greece. But it ran from 333 to 63. And then you had this fourth one, the iron legs, the iron clay feet. It was supposed to be a fourth kingdom. And it was Roman, and it started about 63. And then in the vision, while this image was standing on these iron legs and iron and clay feet, a stone cut out of a mountain without hands came rolling across a plain and struck the image and broke it into pieces and bounced on and pulverized it, and the wind blew the dust away like the chaff on the threshing floor. And that's where we run into the first real issue in terms of the conflict over eschatology. And that is the fact that Rome didn't get destroyed by a rock coming out of the mountain, then Messiah's kingdom wasn't set up. That's where the problem starts. And so we're going to run into some issues a little bit later in the prophecies. But generally speaking, this is a prophecy from Babylon until the stone swells into a granite mountain and his dominion is forever and his reign is everlasting. So it's supposed to go from Babylon to the kingdom. And we're in this period where it's neither Babylon nor the kingdom. So we have to deal with that. But the key point is, history actually followed the prophecy and the prediction of a violent destruction of the fourth empire. That's one of the problems. Now, given that, if you turn to the next one, you have this timeline where you have, from Daniel 2, you have the Babylonian head of gold, the king of kings by divine right, complete dominion of the then known world. Then you have the inferior kingdom, which was, the inferiority there is explained. It's the major issue in chapter 6. The major issue. King, you made a decree, and you can't back out of it. And why? Because of the law of the Medes and the Persians. And that come up over and over and over in chapter 6. And the repetition is deliberate because in chapter 2, Daniel had said, another kingdom will arise after you, which will be inferior to you. And the inferiority had to do with the extent of the sovereignty of the king. He could make any rule he wanted to, but once he made it, he was subject to it, and he couldn't change it. The law of the Medes and the Persians. And then the issue of reign, where you have the head of gold, which is an absolute monarchy, then it's degenerated to a monarch who is capable of making any rules he wants, but he's then subject to them. And then it degenerates even further to Alexander the Great. He spent almost his whole time as king waging war and expanding his empire. And he died when he was 29, 30, 31, somewhere along in there. So you didn't have this divine right thing. You didn't have this law of the Medes and the Persian thing. You just had pure military power, and that was it. And then, of course, along came Rome and finally destroyed what was left of the Greek Empire. And the Roman set of government was supposed to be ruled by the Senate, and the Caesar was supposed to be overseen by a group of men, and that's not anywhere close to an autocratic king. And of course, we have something even worse than that today in terms of the way things develop in terms of who's going to call the shots. And that, keep that in mind. That's the key issue. Who's going to call the shots? And we're always, as human beings, trying to figure out a way so we can call them. So what you had was a timeline that went from the Babylonian to the eternal. And it went through the fourth kingdom of iron to the kingdom of God, because the kingdom would never be destroyed. It'll crush and put an end to all prior kingdoms, and the stone cut out of the mountain crushes the iron, the bronze, clay, silver, and gold. So that's where we are as we begin our study of chapter 7, because Daniel decides to open chapter 7. And remember, he wrote this after all of the stuff had been given to him. He had probably made notes all along, but nonetheless, in 605, he was a young man, very young man, when all this started. But by the time it got down 70 years later, he was an old man. And the stuff that's recorded in chapter 6 and, well, chapters 5 and 6 happened in these latter end of the thing. So he wrote this from the perspective of having gotten it all together now. Now I understand, he says, and that's going to come out later in the book. But chapter 7 says this, in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream. The first year of Belshazzar was 14 years before chapter 5. Okay? Now what that means is that Daniel deliberately messed with the chronology so that he could put the material together in a way that would carry a thematic impact rather than a chronological one. He's not writing chronologically. He's writing thematically. And by the way, in historical narrative, that's not unusual, because every one of the four Gospels, except Luke says he wrote in order. But when you read some of the other accounts, things are not quite in the same order. And so you have to wonder now, why is this? Is this a mistake? Is it an error in the script? None of that. It's a presentation of Jesus from the perspective of the writer, and he's selecting his stories to build his points as he develops the book. And John just flat tells us that. He said, my point is that Jesus is the Christ, and you can have life by believing in him. And that's the reason I wrote these seven signs, or these signs that I've chosen. So he's making no argument at all that these happened in order, except in the text, on certain occasions, he'll say now on the second day or on the third day or, you know. But generally speaking, it's a thematic presentation of Jesus as the Word of God. And quite frankly, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John, all four, had pictures of Jesus in their minds they wanted to present, and all the four come together to present one person, but with different issues and views depending on who wrote them and why. And it's a fascinating study to look at the Gospels in terms of who wrote them. You know, the only of the four that says, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, come to me, and I will give you rest unto your souls. Well, a lot of people blow that word souls off, but the issue of rest in your soul is different than rest in your spirit and health in your body. Rest in your soul has to do with being at peace, being relationally connected properly to God and to the people of God and that kind of thing. And there is one of the four gospel writers who didn't have any rest in his soul because he was a tax collector. He had no peace with anybody. The Romans didn't like him. And the Jews hated him for taking up Roman taxes for the Romans. And the only buddies he had were other tax collectors, and they were probably just as crooked as snakes. And you know what it's like to have friends that are crooked. So I'm telling you that everything about the Gospels and their writers are simply reinforcing this reality that people who write historical narrative biblically don't always follow the chronological order. And Daniel's telling us point blank in chapter 7, verse 1, that he's out of chronological order. He's building the thesis. And that's why we've called this a chiasm. And the main point is chapters 4 and 5, where God is able to humble those who walk in pride. And when they recognize that there's a God in heaven who rules over the affairs of men, then they're ready to be reconciled to him. Well, in chapter 7, what we end up having, according to the structure of the material, and that's what your notes are designed to give you here, is a representation of the same general issue of God's dominion over human history, but it's presented in totally different form. The vision that Daniel has, the dream and the vision in his mind, he writes the dream down and he relayed the following summary of it. So here he's making a record. And part of the record is because at the end of the chapter, he says, at this point the revelation ended, and as for me, my thoughts were greatly alarming me, and my face grew pale, but I kept the matter to myself. And then chapter 8, by the way, starts out in the third year of the reign of Belshazzar. So again, we're in harmony with the first year and now the third year, but we've shifted back to Hebrew. Chapter 8. So, point is, all the way through here, Daniel says, well, for example, chapter 8, verse 27, Daniel was exhausted and sick for days. Then he got up and carried on the king's business, but I was astounded at the vision, and there was none to explain it. He didn't understand. But when he gets to the end of his book, he understands to the degree that he can. Now, there are some things that you're just going to have to wait, Daniel. You're going to go to sleep, and in the last days you'll stand up and be. But point is, he wrote this together to make two major points for two different groups of people. The Chaldeans needed to understand who God was, and the Jews needed to come to grips with the fact that their God was the same God. He's going to be in control. And the Jews didn't like that a bit. They made great noise about their loyalty to Yahweh and all that, but it's a noise. When Jesus came, they murdered him, because all that religious talk was just talk. So Daniel is presenting the last thing to the Chaldeans, to the Gentiles, in chapter 7. And in this case, we have in verses 1 through 8, the four great beasts. He says in verse 2, he was looking in the vision by night, and the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. And four great beasts were coming up from the sea, different from one another. Now, the thing about the sea is that in the interpretation, it says in verse 16, I approached one of those who were standing by and began asking him the exact meaning of all this. So he told me and made known to me the interpretation of these things. These great beasts, which are four kings who will arise from the earth. So now we have the interpretation of the sea. It's the earth. And so, what's going on here? Why is it in the vision the sea that these beasts arise out of, but in the interpretation there are four kings that arise from the earth? Well, I believe that the answer to that is that the sea, and characteristically and even in the book of Revelation in some cases, the sea represents the masses of people. Vast, like the sand of the sea for number. Vast numbers of human beings who are being orchestrated in their behavior by, it calls them the four winds of heaven. But these are spirit influences, spiritual influences. And the four winds of heaven issue may actually have a direct connection to chapter 9, where Daniel is approached by one of the heavenly spiritual authorities. And he says, God heard you the first day you started praying. It's taken me 3 weeks to get here because I got hung up with the king of Persia, or with one of the angelic majesties that had some influence over Persia. I think it was Persia. And so then after he told Daniel, he said, now I got to go back and fight with him. Well, what's this fight? It's a spiritual warfare thing in the heavenlies that has to do with how things are going to go on the earth. And even in the heavenlies, we've got a whole host of renegade creatures that are led by a rebel who, if God says it's going to be this way, they say, no, it's going to be that way. Because what was Lucifer's goal? I'm going to sit on the throne of heaven. I'm going to be in control. So this control thing is, it's at the very root of the spiritual rebellion issue. So anyway, he sees these four beasts, and then he describes them. The first was like a lion, and it had wings of an eagle. And he kept looking until the wings were plucked, and it was lifted up from the ground, made to stand on 2 feet like a man. A human mind was also given to it. Now, just on the basis of what we've already studied, you can almost figure out who this is right off the bat. Because we had a guy whose arrogance caused him to fly as high as heaven, and then his wings got plucked, and he crashed to the ground. And when he was lifted up off the ground, he was made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and a human heart was given to him. That almost sounds like Nebuchadnezzar's testimony, chapter 4. So without anything, we have that as a background. Then he says, another beast, the second one, resembling a bear, and it was raised up on one side, and 3 ribs were in its mouth between its teeth, and thus they said to it, arise, devour much meat. And I kept looking, and behold, another one like a leopard. And he had the 4 wings of a bird on his back, and he had 4 heads. And dominion was given to this, the craziest looking leopard you've ever seen. 4-headed leopard with wings. The evolutionists must have had a heyday when they find the fossils for this. No, I'm kidding. Anyway, after this, he kept looking, and a fourth beast, dreadful and terrifying and extremely strong and large iron teeth, and it devoured and crushed and trampled down the remainder with its feet, and it was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. And while he was contemplating the horns, behold, another horn, this would be an 11th one, a little one, came up among them, and 3 of the first horns were pulled out by the roots before it, and behold, this horn possessed eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth, uttering great boasts. And I kept looking until thrones were set up, and the Ancient of Days took his seat, and his vesture was white, like white snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was ablaze with flames, and its wheels were a burning fire. And a river of fire was flowing, coming out from before him. Thousands upon thousands were attending him, and myriads upon myriads were standing before him, and the court sat, and the books were opened. Does that remind you of anything? in the book of the Revelation. The court is set up and the books are open. And by the way, in the Revelation where it tells about that, it says that every man is judged by his works. And then he was cast into the lake of fire. And you have to wonder now, where's this lake of fire? Well, it says right here that there was this fiery stream issuing out. So apparently that it's right there. And in the book of Revelation says the smoke of their torment from that burning is going to ascend up forever and ever. So there's some of the imagery that we have its roots in here. In verse 11, Daniel was attracted to the fact that the sound of the boastful words which the horn was speaking. This was astounding to Daniel because his theology is God's in control. You respect and honor Him. You don't go around bragging and boasting and carrying on like you're somebody special. But this little horn with eyes like a man and a mouth speaking these boastful words, they were apparently so arrogant and blasphemous that Daniel was curious about what was going to happen. But he kept looking until the beast was slain and the body was destroyed and given to the burning fire. And the rest of the beast, their dominion was taken away, but an extension of life was granted to them for an appointed period of time. And I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, one like the Son of Man was coming. And he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him, and to him was given dominion. So here's the fifth king. Four kings are going to rise, and then the Ancient of Days is going to give a kingdom to one like a Son of Man. And I don't believe it's an accident that in the Gospels, Jesus consistently calls himself the Son of Man. Because he knows that they know Daniel. Anyway, he comes up to the Ancient Days, presented before him, he's given the dominion, glory, and the kingdom, and all the peoples, nations, and men of every language might serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, will not pass away, and his kingdom is one which will not be destroyed. And as for me, Daniel, my spirit was distressed within me, and the visions in my mind kept alarming me. So that's what he dreamed, or saw in his vision. And so I approached someone who was standing by, apparently like in the earlier record, the heavenly watchers. He approached somebody that was standing by there, and he began asking him the exact meaning of all this, and so I made the interpretation known. And here's where we get the pattern. The great beasts are four in number. There are four kings who arise from the earth, and the saints of the highest one receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever for all ages to come. Okay, you go from the four kings to the saints possessing the kingdom forever. Just, there's human history. Now, if you'd have told Daniel or anybody else at the time, this is not going to happen for at least another couple thousand, maybe 2,500, 30,000 years, you know. But that's part of the issues that face us in terms of the control thing. But anyway, Daniel's interest in these four kings, he says, it was focused in verse 19 on the fourth beast. It was different from all the others, exceedingly dreadful. Teeth of iron and its claws of bronze. Now, in this case, he didn't mention the claws in his original record of the dream. But it has teeth of iron and claws of bronze. And it devours, crushes, tramples down the remainder with its feet. And the meaning of the ten horns that were on its head and the other horn which came up and before which three of them fell, namely that horn that had eyes and a mouth uttering great boasts and which was larger in appearance than its associates. Now, he called it the little horn. But now he says its appearance was that it was larger than its associates. So I just call this a little stout horn. He's heavier or bigger in some way, and yet he's a little horn. He keeps looking, and the horn is waging war with the saints and overpowering them. So this particular horn has a focus on the saints. And for Daniel, that's Israel or Judah. And he says he was overpowering them until the Ancient of Days came. Judgment was passed in favor of the saints of the highest one, and time arrived and the saints took possession of the kingdom. So, in the interpretation, notice he skips. He skips the lion and the bear and the leopard and goes straight to the fourth kingdom. He says, the fourth beast will be a fourth kingdom on earth, which will be different from all the other kingdoms, and it will devour the whole earth and tread it down and crush it. As for the ten horns, out of this kingdom, 10 kings will arise. So it's not going to be a unified kingdom like Babylon or Medo-Persia or Greece. This is going to be a kingdom that is comprised of an alliance of 10 kings at some stage. I mean, it's obviously at the end of the whole period, because the 10 kings, the 10 horns, are contemporaries who, it says in verse 24, another will arise after them, and he'll be different from the previous ones and will subdue 3 of them. So you have these original 10, and then you have one coming on a little bit later, and he's different from them, but in some ways he has authority and power to unseat 3 of them. And it says in verse 25, he'll speak out against the Most High and wear down the saints of the Highest One, and will intend to make alterations in times and in law, and they'll be given into his hand for time, times, and half a time. Now, we've already run into this time, times, and half a time thing, and I explained to you back then, and in the book of Revelation it's reinforced that he's talking about years, 360-day years, so that times is 2 and time is 1 and half is half, so you have 3.5 years of 360-day years. And in the book of Revelation, that's all developed into 42 months and 2,520 days and all that. But it says, the court will sit, his dominion will be taken away, annihilated and destroyed forever, and then the sovereignty and the dominion and the greatness of all the kingdoms under the whole heaven will be given to the people of the saints of the Highest One. His kingdom will be everlasting. All the dominions will serve and obey him. And at this point, the revelation ended, and Daniel is alarmed. So let's go, now that we've looked over the details of the dream and the particulars, let's go back to our overview thing here, because we looked at the timeline derived from Daniel. The next page is the timeline derived from Daniel 7. Daniel 2 had the head and the upper body and the belly and then the legs and the feet. So in Daniel 7, you have a lion with wings of an eagle. You have a bear with 3 ribs in his teeth raised up on one side. You have a leopard with wings and 4 heads. And you have this dreadful strong beast. And then you have the kingdom of the Son of Man. Again, this is a timeline of the great big sweep of history. And in the details of it, it says, the lion is one of the 4 kings to arise from the earth, who has wings like an eagle. And you wonder, now, we were already told in chapter 2 that Nebuchadnezzar was the head of gold. And the issue of a lion, because the head of gold meant you were the king of kings. Well, it's no accident that in the scriptures, the lion is the imagery for the true king of kings. Even in the book of Revelation, it says, the lion of the tribe of Judah has overcome. And he looks, and it's not a lion at all. It's a lamb. But the lion imagery was deliberately associated with Christ as the king of kings. So if the head of gold, you are the king of kings, and then you have a lion here that has this backdrop of king sovereignty thing, we're right back to Babylon again. And the wings, the imagery here, the words are that he had wings of an eagle, but his feathers were plucked, and then he was lifted up off the ground. Well, the image that you get from that, at least the image I got from that, was that he was flying high until his feathers got plucked. You remember that story about, was it Icarus or somebody like that?
Icarus.
His dad made him some wings, put them together with wax, told him not to fly too high or the sun would heat up the wax. He got up there and he thought, this is great, so he kept flying higher and higher, and then all of a sudden the wings melted and crash, boom. Well, in the record of 2, in relation to the fact that Daniel totally skips this in the interpretation, he's not really interested in the first 3. He's interested in that loud mouth, little horn. But the fact is, you have this imagery that is really profound and rich in that the head of gold who has been given, God has put this man in place, Daniel says, God sets men over the kingdoms of men, whomever he chooses, even the basest of men. You, O king, are the head of gold. You're the king of kings. Well, in the story of Nebuchadnezzar's testimony in chapter 4, he has this arrogance problem where he is flying high in his own opinion of himself, and all of a sudden, he thinks he's an animal, and he's driven out, and he has to eat grass like probably a donkey, because that's where he was running. He was running with the donkeys, according to his own statement, until his reason returned to him, and he looked up to heaven, and he recognized that God was the ruler. Well, the imagery here is that he got his feathers plucked, and he crashed. And then, from his crash, he was picked up, made to stand on 2 feet, and given a human heart. So, to me, that's explained by chapter 4, the testimony of Nebuchadnezzar. Then you have this bear with its 3 ribs and its teeth and that. Well, Daniel had already told Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 2 that after him another kingdom would arise that would be inferior to him. And Daniel actually lived until that kingdom arose, because he was at Babylon when Belshazzar was slain, and he was the third man in the kingdom, and so Darius took him and made him a part of his kingdom, and he prospered even to Cyrus the Persian. I don't know how many years that might have been. Might not have been years at all. Might have been just a little while, because Darius and Cyrus were working together. But the point is, all that we're told is that he had 3 ribs in his teeth, he was raised up on one side, and he was commanded to arise and devour much meat. Now, we're going to get a whole lot more detail about this kingdom when he's writing to the Jews in the Hebrew, chapters 8 through 12. Then the next kingdom, Daniel had told Nebuchadnezzar, after that kingdom, there'll arise a third kingdom. And in this dream, a third king arises from the earth and dominion is given to it. And that's about all it says. But we're going to get a lot more detail about that, too, later in the Hebrew part of chapters 8 through 12. And then he focuses on the dreadful, strong, large iron teeth, totally destructive. There's a statement in here that says, I desire to know that this is verse 19, meaning that the fourth beast was different from all the others, exceedingly dreadful, with its teeth of iron, claws of bronze. It devoured, crushed, and trampled down the remainder with its feet. The remainder there is what was the residue of the other kingdoms. Babylon was absorbed by the Medo-Persians, and the Medo-Persians were absorbed by Alexander the Great, and Alexander's kingdom, as it finally developed in history, was absorbed by Rome. But this thing, it says that he is different from all the other kingdoms in verse 23, because he devours the whole earth and treads it down and crushes it, and he'll be different from the previous ones and will subdue 3. And the whole point there is, there's this idea that one kingdom absorbs the next one, the next one, the next one. But when this one actually comes to this stage of the game, when it acts, the destruction is total. It builds its own kingdom without having the Grecian kingdom or the Medo-Persian kingdom or the Babylonian kingdom as a part of its thing. And its destructive force is so potent, and it's focused on Israel. Then you have the judgment set, the books open, he's called to account. In chapter 2, it was a stone that was cut out of a mountain without hands, comes rolling across the plain, pulverizes all of them into dust and blows them away, and then the stone swells into a mountain that fills the whole earth. And it's the mountain imagery as a kingdom is clear in Isaiah, because it'll be the mountain of the house of the Lord. That's just another way of saying the kingdom of the house of the Lord. Well, all of this fits together as a timeline that looks something like, and I'm no artist, so y'all can laugh if you want to, but the last handout is a superimposition of the chapters 2 and 7, where you have a tall image standing on the plain with the mountains in the background, and then you have, that's chapter 2, and then you have chapter 7. With the winged lion and the bear raised up on one side and 3 ribs in his mouth and the four-headed leopard. And then, this is just my imagination, this beast. But you'll notice that three of the horns are coming out as this stout horn comes up. It's almost like your permanent teeth, you know, pushes those ones out. This one comes up, deposes three of them, takes complete dominion, and just demolishes everything until judgment is rendered. And that judgment is in the form of this Son of Man, who is the rock that's cut out of the mountain without hand. So chapter 7 is Daniel's final statement. And his final statement to the non-Jewish Gentile world is that the God of the Jews is the one that you're going to have to deal with. The God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God of Daniel, the God of Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, He is the Lord of heaven. He is the one with whom you will deal, and there is not going to be any escape for anybody. People who say, well, when you die, you're dead, are dreaming. That's just wishful thinking. When you die, according to Hebrews, you come to judgment. Now, I don't believe that you come to judgment as soon as you die. I believe that you are reserved, according to Revelation, the judgment that's set up in the great white throne in chapter 19. Death and hell give up the dead that are in them, and they all come and assemble. So there's just going to be this vast assembly in this final judgment, and then everybody's going to be given an opportunity to explain why they shouldn't be cast into that fiery lake, and every one of their works is going to be recorded. And the scariest thing about that whole scenario, well, the scariest thing is the lake of fire and eternity without annihilation. But one of the issues of judgment is Jesus made the comment one time to the religious leaders. He said, every idle word that men shall speak, they shall give an account thereof in the day of judgment. That has never shut my mouth, but it should have. I mean, I don't think enough about that, but I'm not going to be at the great white throne judgment. We're going to be judged as believers prior to that. But even then, we're going to be judged according to deeds done in the body, and I'm assuming the speech that comes out of the mouth. But the issue at this judgment is the issue of destruction. It is no, there's no. This is chapter 5. This is judgment without mercy. This is the end of the human experience on this earth as a fallen race. And we're rushing toward it. And nobody seems to realize that. I mean, everybody's just discounted the Christian message. They've just blown it off. We're post-Christian. There's no such thing as a God. And just because a lot of time has passed doesn't mean the truth has changed. The only thing that changes their truth consistently are the scientists. They'll tell you one thing absolutely dogmatically, this is the way it is, and 10 years later it's completely different. In fact, there was an article on the web today about how the Hubble telescope has finally settled the issue of how big our universe is.
Right, finally.
Yeah, before they launched it, they were debating the size of the universe and all that. Now they've launched it. Now they've seen to the end of the ages and end of the universe, and now they know how big it is and how fast it's expanding. And if the Lord tarries another 1,000 years, 1,000 years from now, all this will just be junk. Because their truth changes. Because they don't have a truth. But the scriptures are the word of God, and that's the issue. In Daniel's confrontation of the Gentile world of his day, the issue is there is a God in heaven who speaks